Alexander Graham Bell is seen as a genius who invented the telephone, but not everyone is pleased with his legacy.
Having grown up with deaf family members, I grew up with a hatred of Bell.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, the story of Bell's complicated history with the deaf community. We'll also hear how women are joining in on Marine boot camp and spend an academic minute doing nothing, like always. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Any grade school student can tell you that Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. But that's not how Bell would have described his greatest accomplishment. He saw himself as a teacher, specifically a teacher of deaf children. However, even though he was raised by a deaf mother and married a deaf woman, many deaf people to this day see Bell as an enemy. He was an oralist, meaning he thought the only way to teach deaf children to succeed in society was to teach them how to speak and to keep them from learning sign language. This is the story Katie Booth tells in her book, The Invention of Miracles, Language, Power, and Alexander Graham Bell's Quest to End Deafness. Katie Booth is a freelance author and part-time writing instructor at the University of Pittsburgh. She was also raised in a mixed-hearing deaf family. I asked Booth why she took on Alexander Graham Bell.
My interest initially was not about Bell specifically, but about the method of education that he spearheaded in America, which was also the way my family had been educated, my deaf family members. And I knew it was really traumatizing to them. And I also knew that it was part of the reason that sign language as a language had to struggle so much to be taken seriously and for deaf people to have access to this language. And so I was interested in all of that, but that's not a story, right? That's a topic. I really resisted Bell because having grown up with deaf family members, I grew up with a hatred of Bell. The cultural story that had been passed down to me was one in which he was the enemy. But the more I looked at his story, the more I realized that it was really complex and that it sort of contained all of the complexities of this method of education that I was curious about.
And of course, the one thing you have in common with Bell is he also grew up in a deaf family with deaf family members.
Yeah, yep. His mother was deaf and his wife was also deaf. Although it's the way that we are quite different is that both his mother and his wife lost their hearing postlingually, which means they already knew language. They already had English language. They already had some form of speech by the time they went deaf, whereas my family was prelingually deaf. They were deaf pretty much from birth.
And I guess the conflict is, just the basic conflict is Bell believed in teaching the deaf to speak, whereas the deaf, it seemed, pretty much wanted to stick with sign language. Is that the basics?
I mean, that's a simplified version. I mean, there were certainly deaf people historically who were interested in speech. I also think it's not quite as much of a dichotomy as that. I think that people who were advocating for sign language-based educations both then and now are not in opposition to speech. They're not in opposition to technology that can help with hearing, but rather they just think that sign is an important support and that at times a critical way to expose deaf children to language.
In Bell's time, how long had sign language, American Sign Language, been in use?
Well, that's a complicated question because, like any language, American Sign Language grew and evolved from other forms of sign language. I think the language that we see now had its roots in the early 19th century with the opening of the American School for the Deaf. But when that opened, it was using French Sign Language. But as people from around, especially the Northeast, came to that school, they brought their own regional sign language to the school. And those regional sign languages had been around long before that. So a long time.
When Bell came on the scene, so to speak, what did the education of deaf children look like at that time?
So at that time, most deaf children who were educated, and not all deaf children and also not all hearing children did receive educations at that time. But if they were educated, they usually went to a residential deaf school, often kind of later in life. I mean, not that much later, they were still children, but sometimes as late as 10 years old, because they didn't have many years for that schooling. So the idea was that they should get it when they were a little older. So they went to these residential schools where usually the language of instruction and the language of life was American Sign Language. And they lived in community, not only with other deaf children, but also with deaf teachers, you know, and deaf employees of the schools. And what that meant was that there were deaf role models in those schools, and they were constantly being exposed to deaf leadership, deaf adults, deaf teachers, deaf people to look up to, which was really important.
How was sign language seen by society at the time? In the book, you write that it was almost seen as, you know, primitive.
Yeah, well, I mean, the story of sign language, the evolution of sign language, the evolution of the way it was seen, rather, is pretty interesting. Essentially, there was a time when it was seen as quite beautiful and expressive and holy, almost. And then as American culture began to really cling to the idea of normalcy being a value, people wanted to be, quote unquote, normal. As that happened, sign began to really be seen as a problem because it made people stand out. And then, you know, Darwin came out with The Origin of Species around then. And under that sort of paradigm, yeah, that's where sort of the sense of it being primitive came in. And so there was a real shift somewhere in the early to mid 19th century, I think, was when things really started to shift.
It shifted so much to the point that in the early 20th century, you're right, there some states had laws mandating that speech be taught rather than sign language.
Yeah, yep. The hold of oralism, the hold of this idea that deaf people had to learn to speak and in order to do that, could not be exposed to sign. That idea really took hold. It dominated for a long time. In many ways, I would say it still dominates.
Is that part of Bell's legacy?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Bell thought of his life's work as being a teacher of deaf people. That was what he thought of as his sort of primary work. It's not the way his story is usually told. And that was true even in his life, which was something he saw as kind of tragic towards the end of his life, or at least sad. But he really believed in this idea of speech and that sign was unnecessary and that speech was better and that sign would sort of hold children back from speaking. You know, when he first started advocating this idea, he was powerful, but, you know, he hadn't invented the telephone yet. But after he invented the telephone, he had a lot of celebrity to sort of put behind this movement, and he did.
There is an awful lot about, I mean, other things Bell has done in his life, of course, you know, burying the lead, not talking about the telephone, but he actually played a part in the assassination of President James Garfield, at least after the attempt. Tell us that story a bit.
Yeah, well, I want to be careful. He didn't play a part in assassinating.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
He did play a part in trying to save President Garfield's life. there's a book called Destiny of the Republic, which goes into this in great detail. But yeah, he was trying to invent a device that essentially could locate the bullet inside of President Garfield's body. That bullet wasn't located until after his death. But the idea was that if they could locate the bullet, they could remove it and save his life. The actual truth of the matter is that if they had just stopped prodding their unwashed fingers into the bullet wound, that would have done a lot more for his health than finding the bullet and removing it. The bullet was sort of lodged peacefully in there and was not actually causing damage by itself, I don't believe. But yeah, Bell traveled down to Washington, D.C., worked with other scientists and worked to try to save the president's life, though he didn't succeed.
One of the places where he demonstrated the telephone was the Centennial Celebration, the World's Fair that went on for 1876. It appears he had a miserable time during that, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Bell was funny. In some ways, he was a really good performer, and that was what so much of his success was based on, was, you know, holding these performances in which he either displayed deaf students or the telephone or whatever. Those two things not being equal, of course, I should say. But at the Centennial, he really didn't want to be involved. His benefactor sort of slipped him into the education exhibit, even though his device was electrical in nature. And yeah, he resisted so strongly. He actually, everybody else, everyone around him, his fiance really wanted him to go. His fiance's father, who was one of his benefactors, wanted him to go. It came down to he wouldn't go. And what happened was his fiance, Mabel Hubbard, packed a bag for him and then took him on a carriage ride. He did not see the bag, apparently. And brought him to the train station and handed him his bag. And that was, they got into a little fight and she wouldn't, she kept turning away. She was herself deaf and she kept turning away from him. So as much as he pleaded and argued, she couldn't, she was essentially putting her hands over her ears is what the hearing equivalent would be, right? She just wouldn't look at him and therefore was just blocking him from any argument. And he did get onto the train and traveled down and caught the attention of some very powerful people. It was a major, major step to getting the telephone out into the world. It was kind of the best publicity he could imagine.
Still to come, our conversation with Katie Booth continues with one of Bell's most controversial statements about the deaf. Plus, I find out just how little I know about the lives of deaf children. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Katie Booth, author of the new book called The Invention of Miracles, Language, Power, and Alexander Graham Bell's Quest to End Deafness. In the book, Booth notes that one of Bell's most infamous statements about the deaf is, and I'm quoting here, "We should try ourselves to forget they are deaf. We should try to teach them to forget that they are deaf." I ask Booth if this is seen well in the deaf community.
Not by most people that I've heard from about those words, or, you know, the record, it's a quote that gets used again and again as evidence of his lack of understanding, his lack of respect for deafness, his desire to do away with deafness, if not physical deafness, then certainly cultural deafness, though he took steps to try to minimize physical deafness as well.
There is certainly no stigma to sign language now. It's almost ubiquitous in any public appearance. How did that change? When did the deaf start to reclaim ASL?
You know, I would have to push back against that idea. There's actually still a huge stigma against sign language when it comes to teaching deaf children. A startlingly small percentage of deaf children learn sign language.
Really?
It's less than 10% use it in their homes and less than 10% use it in their schools. And I'm forgetting the exact, one is 6%, one is 8%, but there's tremendous amounts of research on this by deaf researchers, deaf scholars, deaf scientists. Sign language is seen as beautiful in the hearing world by many, many people. It is still not seen as necessary for deaf children. For that reason, most deaf children are still raised without access to it, which has really sobering consequences. What I think is interesting, and this is not at all my idea, it's very much an idea that deaf people have been pointing out for, my whole life, probably. I think it was in the late 80s or early 90s when we started to see baby signs become popularized, which was, like many forms of sign language in popular culture, it was not deaf-led. It was not sign language. It was a sort of simplified version of I don't know exactly what it was, but there was all of this enthusiasm all of a sudden for hearing babies to learn sign language. And that continues to this day. But at the same time, most parents of deaf children, the pattern seems to be that they are instructed or advised not to let their children use sign language. So I think that you're right that in this sort of popular imagination, there's a glorification of sign language, but I think it's really important to understand that deaf people are still not, are too often left out of that, and actual deaf concerns are often left out of that. Not always. I mean, having an interpreter in the White House is a huge big deal and definitely something that deaf people and organizations were pushing for. But a lot of the representations of sign language are led by hearing people and profited off of by hearing people to this day.
So,
and it's still kept from deaf children.
So was I just a perfect demonstration of how little the hearing world knows about the deaf world?
I mean, yeah, no, I shouldn't.
I mean, I'm happy to help.
Thank you. Yes, that's a good, I think it's true. And I am also a hearing person. I am not a perfect, I am sort of a conduit for these stories, or I try to be. I try to honor the research that I've seen that has come out of the deaf community and the stories that have been told to me and the stories that I have found in my research. But the most powerful stories you will encounter about deafness are those that are told by deaf people, and those are still not, for the most part, still not being embraced by hearing people, by hearing media. The control is still with hearing people.
So what needs to happen? Is there a perfect world where oralists and sign language can come to an agreement and that both are valuable?
I mean, I think oralism, as a rule, excludes sign language. So if so long as that is the case, I don't think so. Sign language educations often incorporate forms of, you know, classes on speaking, but like the broader idea that sign language has no place in our world, I don't think is something, that's not a compromise, that's exclusion, that's oppression. And so I think that there are a lot of initiatives today that are trying to educate hearing people and also to take political action. The Lead K movement comes to mind. I don't know a huge, huge amount about it, but from what I see, it seems to be doing good work. You know, one of the fears about not allowing deaf children access to sign language is not one of the fears, one of the outcomes is something called language deprivation. And there's a lot of deaf researchers, scientists, sociologists who are looking at what's going on there. There's a lot of effort being put into understanding language deprivation. And I think if we're going to have a way forward, I don't think the way forward can exclude sign language. I don't think that that is okay. And I also think that there has to be a real reckoning with language deprivation and what's happening to deaf children.
Well, so Bell might be the enemy then, in the end.
I mean, He did a lot of things that were not very good. That's for sure. He also was a complicated person. I didn't, you know, I started out really hating him, and in the end, I don't know that I still hate him. I don't think that that's true. I think that once you really encounter a person's humanity, what ends up happening is that you learn from them in some way. And I think that that's why, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to write this story, or that I thought it was important to look at Belle, is because I am a hearing person. And this is our history. This is the history of hearing people. This is the history of what we have done and what we have to come to terms with. And so I think just dismissing him as the enemy really lets us all off the hook. I think we need to reckon with the world that he helped create and to work to dismantle some of it.
Again, the name of Katie Booth's new book is The Invention of Miracles: Language, Power, and Alexander Graham Bell's Quest to End Deafness. It's published by Simon & Schuster. A group of female recruits completed Marine boot camp in San Diego this spring. It's the first time the Corps has trained women outside of Parris Island, South Carolina. Congress has mandated that the Marines fully integrate women into its boot camps. Still, it's likely to be several more years before that happens. Steve Walsh reports for the American Homefront Project.
Though isolated, the first group of female recruits to train in San Diego understood people were watching. Some were cheering them on, while others were more negative, like Fox News host Tucker Carlson, who called efforts to accommodate female troops a mockery of the U.S. military. Senior drill instructor Amber Starosik.
They're not oblivious to what happens on social media. So they know what's being said. I think it became more of a challenge to them to push them to be harder than it did set them back.
The cameras often followed the women as they ran, swam, climbed obstacles, and crawled through the California dirt. The low point came midway through the 13 weeks, says drill instructor Stephanie Fall.
When it came to initial drill, they were very, very nervous, and they messed up a lot, and we actually tied for last.
Drill, synchronized marching. The women came in behind the five male platoons. The males are loud as they move their weapons in unison from shoulder to shoulder. Fall says women are meticulous, better attention to detail, but they weren't confident. Then came round two. Final drill, says recruit Marianne Parra.
I think we all woke up and said, why do we put ourselves down? Everyone else is breaking us down. We're supposed to be the ones building ourselves back up.
They won, beating the five other platoons.
And you could tell the moment we hit that parade deck, there was just passion. All of us remembered why we wanted to be a Marine. There were a lot of tears when they announced that Platoon 3241 won drill. We were so happy.
There were more tears to come. Unlike the Marines' traditional training site for women in flat, swampy Parris Island, South Carolina, West Coast boot camp culminates with scaling the Reaper, a summit that looms over training at Camp Pendleton.
And you see the Reaper, even at the Chow Hall. And us girls, even I've overheard male recruits, you see it and you just kind of tremble.
But they reached the top, where they held the traditional ceremony. Each new Marine received an Eagle Globe and Anchor pin, the symbol of the Marine Corps. Para, muddy and sleep-deprived, held it in her palm.
It meant so much more than I thought it was going to mean.
Graduates of West Coast boot camp are dubbed Hollywood Marines. And these women are the first female Hollywood Marines in the 100-year history of San Diego boot camp.
And it's true, looking down at this, I didn't think I was strong enough to be here. Every single day I was scared to be here. This shows to everyone that I actually can. Shows to myself that I'm bigger than I am.
The Marines are the last service to fully integrate women into boot camp. They are under a congressional mandate to open boot camp in San Diego to women, but the deadline is 2028. For now, another cycle of women isn't scheduled for San Diego. Senior drill instructor Starosik doesn't want it to end.
We're on a high right now, and I think the perfect thing for this high would be to continue pushing forward. They can do everything that is done out here. They proved that pretty thoroughly, that yes, they can, and actually they can do it really well.
Champion! 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 Champion!
Though unless something changes, these 53 women are the first, and at least for a while, the last female Hollywood Marines. In San Diego, I'm Steve Walsh.
The American Homefront Project is a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Have you spent the pandemic doing, well, not much of anything? Well, don't sweat it. It appears that's just the way we humans roll. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Not doing much during the pandemic? Don't sweat it. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Ingrid Nelson, associate professor of English at Amherst College, says this isn't the only time we've done nothing.
We've been hearing a lot lately about the benefits of doing nothing for your health, productivity, and society as a whole. These ideas are only the latest iterations of the long history of idleness as a Western philosophical and ethical concept. Ancient Romans developed a model of civic leisure called otium. To practice otium meant retiring from the business of the city in order to study politics, philosophy, and history, and to write new works in these disciplines. Cicero and Seneca argued that these activities not only provided personal enrichment, but also benefited society as a whole. Even so, the Roman philosophers were careful to distinguish otium from self-indulgent idleness, or sloth. In the Middle Ages, theologians sharpened this distinction. They identified sloth by its Latin name, acedia, as one of the seven deadly sins. But they also praised the contemplative life of monks, nuns, and hermits that consisted of activities like study and prayer that served the greater good. In modern exhortations to do nothing, these two concepts of otium and acedia collide with our capitalist productivity culture and the omnipresence of technology. One kind of doing nothing aligns with the concept of otium as a social good, encouraging walking, reading, and engaging with your community instead of your smartphone. And the wellness movement's treatment of idleness rebrands the medieval sin of sloth as a virtue, personal downtime as beneficial to your health. To decide whether you should do nothing, then, it helps to think about which kind of idleness you are choosing, otium or acedia, civic leisure, or personal rest.
That was Ingrid Nelson of Amherst College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.